Welcome back to the Esoteric Christianity course. This is a lesson from part two, Antiquity, entitled The Gnostic Gospels. And really the word gospels here should be in quotes because it isn't a word that is used in the texts or by the groups that we're going to look at in terms of like self-identification or something. It's a later word developed by scholars to kind of collect these things together and to identify as a specific kind of religion, which may or may not actually have even existed, as we're going to look at. And so the word Gnostic actually should also be in quotes, because this term has become increasingly challenged, especially recently, as to its actual historical accuracy and the usefulness in using it to talk about these ideas that we're going to look at. But we will get into that. At any rate, though, for our purposes, talking about Gnostic Gospels is actually helpful for elucidating the theme of this course and for thinking about it, because Gnosticism is often a label given to groups or individuals who represent one of several varieties of Christianity existing in the early years of the religion. And it's these ideas and these kind of alternative streams that we're really trying to get at here with this course. So what is this? Well, this is a slide about philosophy and Plato. And you can see in the image here that it's a representation of the Grove of Academia, where Plato supposedly met with his students and, you know, discussed these topics and so forth. But in order to talk about Gnosticism, we actually have to start here with Platonism. And we must talk about philosophy, but especially this Platonic philosophy and also later Neoplatonic strands of philosophy. Because in this stream of philosophy, especially, philosophy and the practice of philosophy can be understood as a kind of mystery teaching, as a path or as a way to attaining true knowledge and true wisdom, often involving ritual actions and rites of initiation. And this word initiation and this idea we looked at already, especially in the Esotericism 101 lecture. And the process of initiation was thought to produce initiates. And these initiates are wisdom teachers who had attained a certain degree of special knowledge, of esoteric knowledge. And this idea of knowing esoteric things, of having access to special knowledge, this is important for Gnostic groups and these texts that are sometimes identified as Gnostic. This theme is quite prevalent in them, and this theme also comes up again with the later esoteric Christian thinkers that we're going to look at. So according to Plato, real philosophy was preparation for death. The true philosopher should have no fear of death, according to Plato and other Greek thinkers, who insisted that initiation as part of the mysteries was largely concerned with the significance of death. And so sometimes in these rites of initiation, you frequently find mock rituals of death or sacrifice or some connection to death being involved, preparation for dying, something like that, that this was actually what philosophy was about. And it was through this meditation on death, or through this experience of death prior to death, that somehow granted a person the right to hear specific teachings or to know them, or a kind of intuitive revelation of these esoteric teachings. And the way I've sometimes thought about this is, you know, death represents the boundary between worlds. So, you know, when a person meditates, they kind of trick their body into thinking it's going to sleep, and sleep is just kind of one step away from dying. Like, it's no longer thinking, the breathing is slowing down, it's not moving, all the things we associate with living. That if you can sort of artificially bring yourself closer to the state of death, you know, and sensory deprivation is maybe another example of this, that somehow this experience gives a person insight or access to a different kind of knowing, or a different kind of archive of information that exists, you know, beyond the pale. And the mystery rites, or the rites of initiation, which are actually really connected to philosophy, and especially this Platonic philosophy, even though sometimes maybe it's not, especially now with you know, modern analytic philosophy and so forth, we don't necessarily connect these things up in our mind, but Some Platonists use the term mysteria, or they call themselves the mystes, and other terms to refer to their Platonic philosophy. Especially the Neoplatonists are doing this, and all of this philosophy actually emphasized spiritual development through the acquisition of esoteric knowledge, and these rituals that were left out of the history of philosophy, of Platonic philosophy, for a long time, and now only are really being brought back in. These rituals were supposedly brought the philosophers closer to contact with the gods, and of course the gods are all knowing, so closer contact with the gods produces real knowledge, a higher form of esoteric knowledge. And I bring a quote in here from Plato's The Phaedo, or About the Soul, to illustrate what I'm talking about. This text, of course, is famously concerned with, what is a soul, or and what are its qualities, and does it exist, and so forth. And this quote really draws out the point I'm trying to make here about the importance of this kind of philosophy as a mystery teaching. So I'm just going to read this. Quote, "Those who have introduced us to the initiation ceremonies were not men of trivial worth, and they have hinted from long ago now that those who arrive in the realm of Hades uninitiated and not having participated in the ceremony will find themselves lying in the mud, whereas those who are cleansed and have taken part in the ceremonies will, from the moment, live among the gods, because, as they say in the mysteries, many thyrsus bearers, but a few real mystics. And in my view, it is these mystics who are the true philosophers, and like whom I tried to be as best I could during my whole life," end quote. And I think that's a quote from Socrates speaking in the Phaedo, if I'm correct. Plato is putting this in the mouth of Socrates. And it's interesting there because you can see this reference to Hades. That's the realm of the dead. So if you arrive at the realm of the dead uninitiated, in other words, without having prepared yourself through this philosophical practice, which has to do with encountering death, being initiated into mysteries about death, well, then you arrive unprepared, and as it says here, you wouldn't, you're not, you, what does it say? That you'll be lying in the mud. You won't actually achieve this kind of blessed state, or enter the precinct of the gods and so forth. So I've made this cheesy diagram here, where I wrote metempsychosis, which is the Greek idea of reincarnation, or the return of souls to the physical plane for further development. I put this at the top, and I also put the Arabic term al-tanasuk, because this term also is taken up, or this concept is taken up and identified with this Arabic word in the in the reception of Neoplatonic ideas within Islamic philosophy, and we're gonna get to a little bit of that as well. It's a crude diagram, I apologize, but just so you get the idea here, that you see this sort of line in the middle represents time, and this squiggly line that's going in dips, this is the soul as it, in the process of metempsychosis or al-tanasuk, as it reincarnates and returns. And through this process, if it, is able to, as the last quote said, participate in these mysteries, become initiated, follow the philosophical path to true illumination, then you can arrive at the end of this process in the so-called Isle of the Blessed, Isles of the Blessed, something like this, or Field of Reeds, or all these concepts of heaven, or something like that. But those who do not are not able to accomplish this, are not able to become truly initiated, these, are lying in the mud, as the quote said. In other words, they will be going down to Tartarus, or the deepest, darkest place away from the gods, as you can see on the slide here. Just to drive this home a little bit, just to show you how deeply embedded this is in Platonism and Platonic philosophy specifically. This is like the famous example everybody knows about this, obviously, but it's not always thought about in terms of Gnosticism, I don't think. So I wrote up here that this Plato's cave analogy is the OG of Gnosticism, because, and in addition to these allusions to the initiations of the ancient mysteries, Plato famously puts forward this allegory of the cave, in which a type of higher or truer form of knowledge becomes available to the philosopher who is, unchained and, the story. He's taken away from seeing the shadows out into the light of the sun. He's actually dragged out. He doesn't decide to do this. It's an ordeal to enter into the realm of the sun and to see the true light, to have the true knowledge, not this shadows on the wall knowledge. So this I just wanted to highlight here as the kind of really a basic foundation for the idea of Gnosticism. And we're going to go now into Gnosticism proper, some of the texts, some of the groups that were found, especially the Nag Hammadi codices. In addition to that, I mean, even recently, more and more things have been found. For example, the Gospel of Judas was found rather recently. Texts from another group called the Mandaeans have been found, and more information about the religious leader Mani that we've been talking about also have come to light, especially the so-called Cologne Codex, which gives an actual biographical account of Mani. So all of this has really increased our understanding lately of just how rich ancient Gnosticism really was. So now we'll kind of go into the complexities, but I wanted to lay this foundation here about of Platonism and this idea of higher knowledge and knowing and really truly knowing a kind of the esoteric wisdom as a laying a foundation for this idea of Gnosticism. All right. Even though Gnosticism is very complex, contested, does it exist, does it not, and so on, I'm going to try to identify some themes here that most people would recognize as having something to do with Gnosticism. And why am I doing this? Why am I attempting to draw out this idea of Gnosticism here? Really, a lot of these ideas turn up again in especially modern forms of esoteric Christianity. So it's really important to just take some time here to try to at least become familiar with these ideas. And even if now scholars don't necessarily connect them to some kind of Gnostic religion or something, at the time of many of these modern esotericists like Rudolf Steiner, Dion Fortune, and some of these other people we're looking at, even Gurdjieff, Gnosticism at that time was thought more to be kind of a concrete, more of a concrete thing, that more of an actual strand of religion or something. So that's why it's important to, this will help us get into their mindset in a certain sense. And perhaps one common theme that's important for us here, and also was important for these esoteric Christian thinkers that we're going to come to in the modern period, is the idea that the human being is divine. That all human beings are divine, that they possess a divine spark that is somehow asleep or imprisoned inside of us. This is actually hearkening back to the Platonic, some of this Platonic philosophy as well. But there are obvious differences too. So there's this imprisoned spark of divinity within us. And another theme we sometimes find is that the world is ruled by an evil god. And that his evil archons or principalities, they work for this evil god to keep humanity asleep so it cannot access or wake up this divine spark and then realize, become conscious of their own divinity. Human beings must therefore, the process of becoming a Gnostic is to wake up, to know, the word gnosis meaning to know your true nature, that you are divine. And this can only be done through special rituals of initiation again. And above all, through these rituals or through some other means, sometimes through text or through, through hearing the readings, but would still be in a kind of secret setting, I think, you get access to this secret knowledge, which the group possesses. Not everyone possesses this. So that's another thread there. And finally, the emphasis on personal experience of revelation or spiritual realities. This is also, you find, in quote-unquote Gnostic groups, as opposed to just following some doctrine or belief system or something. Gnosticism, in a certain sense, is identified with this idea of experience, of having to know your own divinity. You have to have some kind of experience to have, so that you know it, so that you're not just believing it, in other words. So either that's Either that happens in the initiation ceremonies, or it can happen in a kind of mystical visionary experience, you know, things like this. So those are some, if we put those things together, that's a kind of snapshot of Gnosticism. But just a little bit of the background here is, you know, when is Gnosticism, when are these Gnostic groups, or schools of Gnostic thought, sometimes is also the way people talk about it. They're around at the time of early Christianity in the Roman Empire. Between, you know, the death of Christ and Constantine, there's a lot of syncretism going on, meaning that there are many different types of religions from East, from West, from Persia, and from Africa, Northern Africa, and so on. There, the Roman, the Jewish religion, you know, these things are mixing together and forming different expressions. And so this syncretic element is obviously clearly part of Gnosticism because of the context in which it emerged. You know, these pagan practices, the later, like when we looked at Irenaeus, they accused these Gnostics of having pagan practices as part of their belief system. This word pagan just meaning, you know, kind of rustic or country person not living in the city. And especially after the Roman Empire was Christianized, this is a kind of this idea of pagan practices that are outside of the polis becomes a big part of this. And so there's a clash, you know, between these cultures, between these different religions, and they need to be through this clash. You know, there are texts written, like such as Irenaeus, there are decrees, and there are you know, councils convened to discuss all this, to find out exactly what is the right way to believe in Christianity and what is not. You know, what is the true Christian culture, we could say. And this, you know, is still not sorted out, I don't think, but it's sorted out in ways, in the sense that it's divided, but it's divided up into different pieces. But this early moment is really key for you know, understanding what these Gnostic groups were and why they were, how they were formed, and you know, who composed these groups. And again, when we look at the later esoteric Christian thinkers, a lot of times you find this idea that somehow Christianity has been corrupted, and that it is the true way. It is the, you know, it is the reality, but that it was corrupted by one church or another, by, you know, one ruler or another, and so therefore that you have to get back to this earlier time, these earlier forms of Christianity, and that's when you encounter some of these Gnostic ideas again, and then often they are attempted to be reincorporated into Christianity. So as I mentioned, this word, you know, gnosis, meaning knowledge, knowing, spiritual awareness, this is crucial for the group. But this, as I said, is this particular kind of knowledge, usually about this inner divine spark. And you definitely find this in the 19th century, people trying to approach spirituality, whether Christian or not, just any kind of esotericism, going for this divine spark within idea. And like the Theosophical Society, for example, they get really interested in Hinduism or religions, different religious traditions in India, because you can frequently find, they frequently thought they found this idea there, that the, you know, human being is an expression of Atman, and has this Atman within them. Yes, so salvation through spiritual awareness is doctrine of the Gnostics, just finishing up the slide here. And there's another aspect of this, which I'm not going to get into, about Gnosticism, its connection to the Hermetic tradition. We're not really talking about Hermeticism here, but I mentioned it briefly in my Esotericism 101 lecture, I believe. But this is a thought to be religion coming from, or a religious prophet or teacher coming from Egypt, whose ideas were spread throughout the Roman Empire. So there's this Egyptian connection as well. But I'm not going to go into the Hermeticism thing here, even though it is relevant. Especially now, people do not. In the past, Gnosticism and Hermeticism were conflated, but now they're kept, for the most part, separated. But when we get to, for example, Pico and Ficino and Plethon and these kinds of people a bit later, especially in the talk on Pico, we will definitely have to go into, or on Ficino, pardon me, there we'll definitely go in more into this idea of Hermes Trismegistus and Hermeticism. So then there, you know, is this clash element between different expressions of Christianity, different spiritual approaches between Gnostics and Christians. Of course, they're all kind of Christians, but the idea is that there's a clash between people representing Christianity or Orthodoxy and then these Gnostic groups which are believing all sorts of other things, and that there's this clash. So, you know, we talked about Irenaeus, but the full title of Irenaeus's text that he wrote against all of these other groups is On the Detection and Overthrow of the So-Called Gnosis. Another way it's sometimes translated, On the Detection and Overthrow of Knowledge Falsely So-Called. So this final phrase, knowledge falsely so-called, it's a quotation, a reference to the quotation from Paul in 1 Timothy, where there's an admonition there against this quote-unquote knowledge falsely so-called, end quote. And this is really directed at these groups who were calling Gnostic, who claimed this particular kind of knowledge about the spiritual salvation and so forth. So it is true that in this Irenaeus against heresies, this idea of gnosis is being directly attacked. And of course he's writing about this is the beginning of there even being such a thing as Gnosticism, as when these church fathers and so forth and Irenaeus are writing about it and attacking especially this idea, which is described and we see only through their eyes. So that's why it's a bit problematic. But nevertheless, I mean, there is this idea of Gnosis is a huge problem for them and a huge huge part of what's going on here. Just in case we aren't all familiar with the history or, you know, having a brief summary of the background can nevertheless be helpful, even if we know it, just to really position ourselves in understanding this context that we're looking at. So this, and especially this idea of councils will come up again later. So Gnosis is being attacked. There are many different expressions of early Christianity. There's this Platonic philosophy running around and very many syncretic groups. And so the famous story of when Constantine converts to Christianity, he then Christianizes the Roman Empire. And this is the story that eventually leads to the canonization of the books of the New Testament. So famously convenes this Council of Nicaea in 325, in which he invites all these different bishops, and he says to them, you know, work this thing out. Which ideas do we accept and which do we not? What is Christianity, according to the story? And then this is done, and this produces not only the books of the New Testament, but, you know, this is the end of these other groups are being definitely kind of sealed out of the process here. And this produces the Nicene Creed. And the Nicene Creed itself is a kind of effort to root out Gnosticism, especially what they called what they thought of as something like Gnostic dualism. Now, not all Gnostic groups believe in a dualism, but certainly some do. And this Gnostic dualism, we've talked a lot about dualism. We're talking about Mani's dualism, moderate dualism. This theme of dualism will come back a lot in reference to esoteric Christianity. Gnostic dualism is like a strict split between matter and spirit. Spirit and light is good. That's of God. Matter is dark and evil. And there's a strict separation between these two things. Never the two shall meet. And according to this history here, as it's frequently, we could argue about how historically accurate all these stories are, but generally speaking, it's okay. They were trying to get out this idea. This Gnostic dualism was a problem, and the creed was, in part, an effort to get rid of that. And therefore, the creed establishes that Jesus Christ was the same substance of God the Father, as well as fully human. So there is no dualism here, but there's no split between these two things. The creed establishes that the Christ, Jesus, was both. Very briefly, to wrap up this part about the Nicene Creed, I just want to show you a few images here. The one here is from the Greek Orthodox tradition, which shows all of the bishops who were convened and shows Constantine standing there with them, holding the result of this Council of Nicaea, in the Greek, the Nicene Creed. And then there's a Latin expression on the other side, which shows Father and Son and God and Spirit, and it says non est, not that, not that, not it, not it, and then but they all kind of converge in this triangular expression that they're all somehow separate but the same. This is the emergence of also this Trinity idea, but it has a background against this Gnosticism and these Gnostic ideas, which is why I wanted us to take the time to just look at this briefly. But to really understand Gnosticism, we have to jump ahead now into the 20th century, because in the 20th century was the discovery of the library, the text fragments of the Nag Hammadi, of Nag Hammadi in 1945. And until this discovery, really what we were just looking at with Irenaeus and these councils being convened and the writers of these Orthodox or proto-Orthodox Christians and Christian leaders, that was our best surviving contemporary description of Gnostic practices and beliefs. So even when we look at the esoteric Christian thinkers of the 19th century, they were mostly reading those guys, and there were fragments, there were some texts. It's not like there wasn't anything, but this discovery in 1945, so-called Nag Hammadi codices. These are mostly Coptic texts from the early Christian centuries, about around the same time, actually. And this is actually one of the most significant, most important finds in archaeological history, some people would say. And I would tend to agree with that, because prior to this, there was really no way to read the texts of Gnostic groups and schools of Gnostic thought, read their texts. We had to rely almost entirely on these Orthodox and proto-Orthodox Christian leaders, but finally in 1945 there was this trove of texts hidden clearly, and then that had been hidden just to save them, and now they had been found. So now we could actually read these their ideas and beliefs as scholars could for themselves, and they were found in Egypt. And it was on the heels of the findings of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we have also talked about in the course. So these two discoveries together really were very significant for understanding. It changed a lot, actually. It confirmed some things and changed some things that 19th century esoteric Christian thinkers had said. Sometimes it confirmed it, actually, but many times it also changed it. So that'll become clear throughout the course, I think. But for me, I've also found it very interesting that this discovery happened right at the end of World War II. So this is really like a turning point in history, in religious history here, and in history of the West, because I don't think that the discovery of these texts has really still fully been integrated into Western psyche. The one problem is that they're difficult to read. There's only fragments, and so there's still like ongoing work in terms of making them available to the public. But even up to this point, I mean, they have had a significant impact. You can go in and get a book called The Other Bible or the Gnostic Bible. When I was teaching in these courses on Intro to Religious Studies, I would hold up this Other Bible to the class and be like, "What's this Other Bible? Is the Gnostic Bible?" So it's like, what is one to do with all of these texts now? And World War II is ending. These texts are found, and perhaps the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, himself a kind of esoteric Christian. He called himself a Gnostic, or he kind of struggled with was he a Gnostic or just a Christian, but he was definitely interested in these Gnostic ideas, in esoteric Christian ideas. And he said once that the finding of these texts was like the releasing of a mental virus in the West. That the world was never the same after these texts were found, that just by opening them, like you can imagine, when the tomb of King Tut was opened or something, and supposedly this, like, whatever was in there was let out, a curse, and the people got sick, or it's kind of legendary. Some of it happened. I don't quite know the story, but it's an idea like that. Like, these texts were contained some kind of mind virus, he called it, a mental virus that were they were lost here and hidden away. And then in 1945, they're found and open and release this virus. It's a positive virus also, you know, according to Dick. But interesting idea to think about. And it is significant how much has changed, especially like the connection between Gnosticism and science fiction. You know, just think of the Matrix or something. Like, after 1945, these things start to become part of the culture. But, you know, what, just to mention briefly, what are in these? What exactly was found? What are the contents of some of these texts? Well, they talk about initiations, actually, mystery initiations, similar to with the Platonic stuff I was pointing out. They found new gospels, stories, in other words, or narratives, recounting different parts of the life of Jesus that were not in the canonical texts, that were not in any other text for that matter. Sometimes you could find them in other branches of Christianity or in different Islamic groups and so forth. And as I mentioned before, even since then, another text was found, the so-called Gospel of Judas, which has a totally other reading of Judas and what he did. He in this reading, he ends up being like in on the whole plot and kind of the most pious follower of Christ, the most, you know, the most closest to him for making being the one to commit the evil, making this sacrificial act, and so on. So it's like a reversion of this other narrative of Judas that goes all the way back through European history and through the Middle Ages, and as being, you know, the evil one under the thumb of Satan or something. So that's interesting. It also sheds a new light on some of Pauline material. And really, the most important thing it did is we only had this limited understanding of Gnosticism based on the writings of these Christian leaders. And now, finally, this revealed just how diverse these groups really were, just how diverse early Christianity really was. You know, even the finding of these things is rather mysterious, and it's really that even that's quite interesting. And you know, I don't know the background, but I know some scholars who work on Gnosticism, and it's quite a debate over what exactly happened, who found these. So there's even the origins are a bit shrouded in mystery. And if you're interested, you can go look it up. But you know, there's a kind of like standard narrative of how these were found, and then there is a bunch of other inconsistencies and strange details. But this is supposedly the person who found him, this farmer named Ali, standing next to his mother. And he supposedly found the texts while he was out in the field or out in the desert or something, and then brought them back and didn't know what they were. And supposedly, like, his mother even used some of the fragments of the text as burned them as in the fire for like kindling or something. Just an example of how they actually look. You know, this is another reason why the work on these things is ongoing. It's not easy. Even trying to interpret these things comes with its own set of problems, and people can contest this and that. And you can, I mean, that's the actual picture of them there, and you can see on the other image here of the kind of state that they're in. So they have to be, you know, it's fragments really. They have to be pieced together. They have to be combed over and tried to, you know, to strain to try to read them and put them together. So it's not an easy task. Well, let's get into the meat of this thing. So what did Gnostics actually believe? Well, there's really no uniform answer to that question. Why? Well, there are some problems with the use of the term as a descriptive category, as I mentioned, as to whether or not there was a historical reality of such groups who even called themselves Gnostics or can be pointed to as Gnostics. So that means when you want to try to define what Gnostics believe, there are lots of different types of Gnostic groups, and they believe different things. And also, they rarely, if ever, self-identified as Gnostics. I mean, there are some, like, references, some things you could use as evidence to try to say, well, here's a Gnostic group. For example, the Mandeans, the word in their native language, I don't know the specifics, supposedly means knowledge in their language. So they called themselves the Mandeans, those who are the knowers. So they're okay, here we have a Gnostic group, perhaps. But there have been some linguistic critiques on this as well, as that's not actually, there's a different word with a different kind of meaning. And that's actually what this is a reference to. It's not reference to the verb to know or something, or this special kind of knowing. So even here, maybe this is not then a Gnostic group. So you arrive into all these problems as to, well, who can we say are Gnostics? The Christians, the Christian leaders, they were the ones who said these groups were called Gnostics, or they pointed to them as using this term as Gnostics. They didn't say Gnosticism, but they called them Gnostics. So this is a term, a label given to them by their detractors. And so again, if you're trying to find what did they believe, what did they call themselves, did they think of themselves as Gnostics, or is this just their detractors using this label on them, kind of smearing them with it or something? That's the problem. That's the question here. So because there's that problem, nevertheless, it's important to go through Gnosticism. It's really key to esoteric Christianity, actually. So I'm attempting to do this in a different way, and I'm just going to present some Gnostic themes. Themes from the school of Gnostic thought, something like that. Because these themes, such as the human being being divine, human beings having this divine spark, as an example, these really turn up a lot in different expressions of esoteric Christianity, different versions of esoteric Christianity. So that's why I want to run us through now some themes in the school of Gnostic thought. Another problem is with the idea of gnosis. So we have Gnosticism as a thing, Gnostic groups who are composed of Gnostics. Okay, there's those problems, but then there's the problem of what exactly is gnosis. And here again, not all of these groups have the same definition of what this gnosis is. It can be a higher knowledge of a variety of things. A common one, or especially after the discovery of the Nashmadi library, until more recent work has been done, a common one is this idea of knowing the divinity, the spark. But another one is something like knowing about the demiurge, which is this false evil ruler who rules the earth and with his minions tries to keep human beings asleep from waking up to their own inner divinity. But again, you get different definitions, different expressions of this gnosis, meaning different things in these groups. So there's even some problems with this idea of gnosis. But there are enough similarities that scholars have attempted a generalized definition. So I pulled out a few here that I think are helpful. One scholar defines gnosis as, quote, individual revelatory experience of the ineffable God. So I think that's a pretty good. So in this one, the experience part is there, as I mentioned, rather than belief or doctrine. It's revelation. It's a visionary quality to it. And in this case, Gnosticism is, you're having because if God is ineffable, it cannot be described in words. So you're having some kind of knowledge of a revelatory experience of that a reality and your connection to it, I would add. And this is the inner divinity part. Like another example that's pointed to a lot, which you might know, is Carl Jung famously said, I do not need to believe in God. When an interviewer asked him, he said, I do not need to believe in God, I know. And this is referencing, again, this experiential dimension that he somehow had some experience that gave him this knowledge of God, that he didn't need to believe in it. So I mentioned another scholar of esotericism, Wouter Hanegraaff, in a previous lecture in his book, Esotericism in the Academy. So in this book, he describes, it's either in this book or in an article, I can't remember, but his definition of gnosis is also interesting. He says, quote, gnosis emphasizes the total inadequacy of discursive language to describe God, and also gives us instead idealized narratives of how it has been attained by exemplary seekers, end quote. These exemplary seekers are the initiates. So, of course, Gnosticism as a discrete religion did not exist, as we mentioned. Even the idea of Gnosticism as a school of thought, as I'm trying to present it here, is problematic and difficult to properly delineate, mostly because the so-called Gnostic groups were so diverse. The character of their Gnostic knowledge was often different. And the way that such knowledge was achieved, the means by which they attained this gnosis, also varied significantly across geographical regions, but also across history. So in other words, the notion that all Gnosticism despises matter and the body, for example, this Gnostic dualism, this is not exactly correct, because some groups did not necessarily have the same belief, did not articulate it quite like that. So there are a lot of these groups. The most famous are the Valentinians, the Sethians, the Barbello Gnostics, the Ophites, Manichaeans, the ones that I'm quite interested in. Dualists in general can be labeled Gnostics, especially by the Christian leaders, and so on. So let's look at some of the actual beliefs of these groups. This is a key aspect that forms part of Gnosticism, but also of Platonism, Neoplatonism, and you find all throughout later versions of kind of Gnostic Christianity or esoteric Christianity. And this is the idea that there is a tripartite division of the human being. That is to say, the human being is composed of different bodies, different subtle bodies, they're sometimes called. There's a physical body, and there's a soul, and then there's a spirit, in this case, and sometimes there's other bodies as well, other subtle bodies. But for the Gnostics, generally speaking, they held to a kind of tripartite division, meaning three parts. That is to say, the pneuma body, which is pneuma being the Greek word that we use for spirit. Now, this is the highest body, and it's the highest aspect of the human form, the human being. And it's this part that undergoes metempsychosis or reincarnations in the systems in which this occurs. For example, in Plato, this is part of his religious philosophy. So the second part is the psychic, where also we get the word soul from. And this is the second highest as well, and the part that's attached to identity, passions, feelings, instincts, these sorts of things. And then finally, you have the hylic body, meaning the material or the physical body. And this is the lowest human aspect and the lowest class of human beings as well, according to some Gnostics. So in addition to this tripartite structure of an individual human, they also divided classes of human beings, meaning of the whole human species, into these three classes, with the pneuma humans at the top. And these are like the Gnostics, the spiritual enlightened ones who were, you know, who are aware of metempsychosis, aware of other things, aware of like esoteric knowledge. Then you have the psychic class of humans, and these are like somewhere in the middle beneath that, maybe have some kind of awareness, but are probably in the most part ruled by their psychic body, meaning their passions, their emotions, and sort of stuck in this sphere. And finally, the lowest class is this hylic or material humans, and these are humans that have like no kind of connection to a higher psychic state, for that matter, nowhere near the pneuma state. And so this, of course, for the Gnostics would constitute most humans, actually. And this is the sort of hylic or materialistic humans.
I'm basically running through themes that these groups share, while also at the same time telling you about some of these groups in terms of their background, their differences, and so on. But these common themes, the ones that I picked, are the most crucial for understanding Christianity, in my opinion, especially with these later expressions of it, the modern expressions of it. So one group is referred to as the Sethians. And one of the, again, you find versions of this theme in different ways amongst different groups, but in the Sethian expression of it, there is this trope of the serpent is actually being good, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, that is, that giving human beings this knowledge of good and evil was actually a good thing, that the serpent was actually working for the humans to give them this gnosis against this demiurge, this evil god who was trying to keep them asleep. Why are this in this group? This is a central component of the belief system of this Sethian group. Why are they called the Sethians? Because they focus on the third son of Adam and Eve. So Adam and Eve had Cain and Abel. When Cain slew Abel, it's kind of cryptic passages and other texts someone could look at with the story of what happened after that. Well, it's something like an angel gave another child to Eve called Seth, a kind of replacement for Abel. And that this, the Cain lived on, of course, and was banished and had his own progeny. And this was seen as a kind of evil stream of humans, I suppose. Whereas this Seth, this replacement for Abel, this Seth stream, this was the representative of a divine kind of savior progeny. And it was this Sethian stream to which these Gnostics claimed they belonged to, that they were attached to the progeny going back to Seth. And they sometimes glorified the serpent as liberator of humanity. And the serpent, you know, what is it here? Is it Satan? Is it the devil? Is it Lucifer? These divisions will become important later as well. But this notion here that the serpent is representing freedom, let's say it's Lucifer. That's what I would want to connect it with for my purposes, because 19th century esotericists and 20th century and, well, actually just all through the early modern and modern period, Lucifer became this symbol of freedom, rebellion, and so forth. So here you find something kind of like that with this idea of the serpent being the liberator in the garden, freeing Adam and Eve from this like mental prison, ignorance in a certain sense. And so this, for the Sethians, the serpent function, you know, had this role in their mythology, in their system. And there was another group called the Ophites who had a similar idea about the serpent being the serpent as liberator. And there are some elements of apocalyptic Judaism in these groups as well. This is how do they know these things? They have these revelations, that knowledge is unveiled to them. This is part of it as well. And also, you know, baptism, ritual baptism is another important part of it. So that was the Sethians. Now I want to talk about and introduce the Valentinians, as well as the Apocryphon of John, which I'm going to, some of what I talk about next is coming from this text. This text is a key example of a Gnostic text that includes many of the elements that we would associate with Gnosticism, especially Gnosticism as a form of religion, as it was talked about in the 20th century and as it was written about during that time. The text is also written as a form of revelation that the author has received. So the author is undergoing this process and has a revelation, receives the gnosis. And the gnosis then, such as in apocalyptic Judaism, for example, the true knowledge is revealed, some higher reality is revealed, and then it's put into this text as a revelation that has been granted to the author. So then the Sethians are arguably the earlier phase of Gnosticism, let's say, in the first century. Then you get this Valentinian phase, which is later in the second century. And this group is centered around some of the ideas in this text. Their leader was this second century Alexandrian teacher known as Valentinus. And they had a strong emphasis on cosmology and mythology. And it's here that we find most of our most familiar themes of Gnosticism together, such as the idea of an evil ruler, the demiurge, evil creator god, sometimes called Yaldabaoth, Here we also find the mythology of Sophia and the fall of Sophia, Sophia meaning wisdom in Greece, in Greek. Here you also find the archons related to the fall of Sophia, and so forth. So these Valentinians, though, seem to have functioned more like a church as opposed to an actual secret group, such as, say, the Sethians. So it's more, so there's similarities between the two. This is, again, why there's a problem with calling them both Gnostic or not. I mean, some people would want to argue that these Valentinians were one expression of early Christianity among many others. Gnostics like the Valentinians asked big what-if questions. They philosophized on broader, abstract problems such as, where do we truly come from? How was the universe created? What is the true nature of evil? This kind of thing. And the answers to these questions for them required this gnosis, this process of receiving gnosis. And this gnosis was actually representative of the personal connection between the human and the divine. This personal knowing of the divine as opposed to faith or doctrine or something, this enabled access to the true gnosis, to the answer to these kinds of larger questions. And how did you then acquire how did you acquire this gnosis? Well, there through study, through meditation, but also through initiation. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. So there were actual rituals sometimes. It wasn't just praying or having access to these ideas or something. Often there were actual rituals involved, visualizations and so forth. But it also, you know, study and meditation was related to ascetic practices. So this was also definitely part of it. But the acquisition of gnosis, once you started to undergo this process, this actually awakened or ignited the divine spark within, granting reabsorption into the cosmic pleroma. This is the way you hear it talked about in this secret book of John and Valentinians and so forth. The pleroma, it's like, and to some extent, we could say like the Father God or the Ineffable Father God, something like that, but it's specific. Means the fullness, or literally, you know, the fullness of God, all of the aeons plus God, aeons, different spiritual beings ruling over different ages, all of this together, like the source, you know, this is the pleroma. And so gnosis was acquired through awakening this part of you related to this pleroma and sort of reabsorbing into it. Becoming, realizing you already are one with it, but it's like realizing you are one with it. This allowed for the acquisition of gnosis, which could then be presumably applied to answering these larger questions. But I imagine they're answered more in the terms of visionary experience. Let's run through this Gnostic creation story related to the Valentinians and the secret book of John and so forth, because here we'll find many of the ideas that are most commonly associated with Gnosticism as a religion, as a religious expression. And they have this different mythology, different creation story. Of course, the idea of the aeons comes in later in modern esotericism as well, so we want to talk about that. So in this creation story, God is the source of everything that lives and everything is good. But the material world and all that human beings experience in it, this is filled with suffering and death. And yet the spiritual world of light is filled with divinity and goodness, the material world filled with darkness. So here is this classic Gnostic dualism that was so problematic for these early Christian leaders that we, such as Irenaeus, said with the Council of Nicaea, was partly involved in rooting this out of Christianity. And here we find but how is this possible? How did this come to be according to this creation story? Well, in the beginning, God, the divine parent as it's referred to, extended itself out and produced other divine beings that were separate from it but connected, and these they call the aeons. All of these aeons combined, along with God, the fullness, this is the pleroma, as I mentioned, There are many of these aeons. One of the aeons is called Sophia. The aeons sometimes are related to different qualities, not always. So Sophia means wisdom. This particular aeon fell. When Sophia fell, her divine pieces, she kind of shattered into materiality. We could think about it this way. And the pieces of her, her divine pieces, were scattered and dispersed across the earth and frozen, meaning hidden, in the material world. So there was all of this slumbering light, the slumbering divine sparks of Sophia hidden in the material world. A false creator god, the Demiurge, sometimes called Yaldabaoth, as a consequence of this, which I'll show you in the next slide, this Demiurge became the lord of this false world of illusion. And then, in this Gnostic version, Jesus came to earth to destroy this false god. So you have this Gnostic dualism trope, but even here, it's not a kind of strict dualism, because within this matter, it's true matter is evil, but within it is the light. So this dualism thing is tricky, and I think it's important for us to talk about, because there's strict dualism, there's moderate dualism. Sometimes what we think of as dualism perhaps isn't precisely the same thing. I mean, it's more complicated. It's true that matter is evil and darkness, but within the matter is the light. You can see it a little better in this diagram. This is taken from classic book of we're collecting the Gnostic texts and explaining it. And there's provides this diagram where you can see the parent on the side here. The realm of light we see here is the good side, where you find the parent, the fullness, the Pleroma, the divine parent is on this side. Then you get these 10 aeons. You can see extruded out of this divine parent, this so-called first principle. Christ is also related to these aeons. And you can see here the different stars. You see the different kind of angels, I suppose. And then you see these stars, the different aeons. And one of these stars, the bottom here, it says Wisdom Sophia. And this is the one that falls and breaks through the barrier here, I suppose, into the realm of darkness. In some of the Gnostic texts, I'm not sure if it's this one, it's because she falls in love with she falls in love with humans, something like that. There's a few different accounts of why she falls. I think one is that she actually cares about humans and falls in love with them or something like that. And the response of this action makes her fall. Scattered, her divine pieces are scattered, as I mentioned. And as a kind of like reaction to this, a consequence of this, this Yaldabaoth, or this craftsman, evil craftsman, is created as the ruler of this world, this realm. This world is created this way. This 365 rulers that you see there, these are the so-called archons. These are like the henchmen of the Demiurge, meant to keep human beings asleep to their own divine connection to the Sophia. And then up at the top there, where it says Act 3, just like an illustration, it says Genesis, in the book of Genesis, about Adam and Eve. And as I already described about Cain, this is the Sethians also share this. Cain representing the non-Gnostics, and the Sethian line representing the Gnostics. But it's interesting here at the bottom, you can see this, it says Heavenly Savior. And it goes around this to come in. Role of Jesus is actually to subvert this whole thing and enter into this drama, essentially, and as the savior, and bring all the Gnostics home. I think you can already see many elements of just that very brief overview I went through of one Gnostic creation account. Many elements in esoteric, modern esoteric movements, modern occult movements, the so-called New Age movement, stuff like this, all connected to whatever esoteric Christianity is. And of course, part of this course is trying to figure out what exactly we mean when we say esoteric Christianity. Do we just mean a more mystical understanding of the faith within Christianity itself, within some I don't know, authorized denomination or so forth, or Orthodox, you just have a deeper mystical understanding? I don't think so. I think part of it is definitely bringing in beliefs that fall outside of the Orthodox understanding. And some of those beliefs perhaps were held by Gnostic groups. And so the idea of divine sparks, some of this dualism stuff, I think is important. So I'll leave that all aside for a second, but I think you can already will be able to see some of those ideas in whatever you know about esoteric Christianity now. Another one that is going to be important for especially the Steiner talk that I do later, and some of these other sort of theosophically linked esoteric Christians, theosophical society that is, also turns up in Gnosticism. And I just want to bring that in here. And this is the idea of, so we've looked at the creation story, but there's this, which is a reinterpretation of that, reinterpretation of the serpent's role in this, and a reinterpretation of Adam, actually, that I want us to look at here briefly. And this is the so-called androgyne Adam. Now, like with all of these ideas, it's interesting because sometimes you can find versions of this, perhaps not so so imaginatively outlined within, say, Catholicism or Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Christianity or something. One thing that perhaps these esoteric Christians do is expand on these things based on their own revelation, right? Based on their own revelatory experiences. So this, we have the account of Adam in Genesis. We have the Orthodox understanding. I think if you ask someone, I don't know, on the street or someone maybe who is not a Christian or who is, but not in any very, and doesn't study it per se, they would know the story about, you know, Adam and Eve, Eve being created from the rib of Adam, this kind of thing. But the Gnostics talked about it in a different way, as that the original human was an androgyne, was both of these genders, was Adam and Eve put together, actually. And not only that, it was somehow connected to the creation itself. So there's this like differentiation process happening. But the primal human, the first human, is usually talked about in terms of an androgyne. And this picture in the middle here is from illuminated manuscript from the Middle Ages, where perhaps it's hard to say they have some kind of understanding of this, because if you look at it, it looks like Adam and Eve are the same being in this picture, and that, okay, God is extracting Eve out of Adam by his rib. Is a more exoteric way to think about it. But of course, when you think about in an exoteric context, someone being created out of the person's rib, what does that look like exactly? I mean, I think here you can see there, it's two beings being divided into one being. This dividing process is also reinterpreted in the Gnostic, and very important in Gnostic, in some Gnostic texts, and talked about in terms of, like, this is the creation of evil, not because, you know, woman is evil or something like this, as we just saw with Sophia. In that sense, this goddess Aeon has a crucial role. But here it's something like the division of the genders from a unity into a binary is related to the origins of evil. I'm not going to go too much into it, but I just want to flag this. This idea also found in Gnosticism, because in Steiner, in the Theosophists, this androgyne Adam is really important, and they talk about it a lot. And who knows to what extent, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit more about Byzantine Christianity in the Steiner lecture. You know, to what extent do these Middle Ages, to Christianity in the Middle Ages, Byzantine groups retain some understanding, some kind of deeper understanding that has been increasingly lost around a variety of things. For example, this idea of Adam and Eve of Eve being born from Adam, something like that. Here's just one more example to take a quick look at of one of these is later that even in the Renaissance period, perhaps early Renaissance, you find artists depicting it this way of like here's Eve being extracted from Adam. It's just that these Gnostic groups and these esoteric Christian thinkers have a whole other layer of interpretation to this. It isn't just the rib story or something, or it's not so simple as the two beings being separated like this. But even here, clearly we see there wasn't like Adam and Eve, that somehow Eve is part of Adam. So the androgyne then, the primal human then, especially in these Gnostic groups, is androgyne, is not a male person. It's both genders together, and kind of no genders at the both, neither gender at the same time, if you see what I'm saying. It's kind of another layer of esoteric interpretation that can be drawn out here. Let's follow this reinterpretation idea, this subversion idea, a little bit further, because it turns up all over the place. So, for example, Gnostics, I'm talking about Valentinians mostly at this point, related to the Secret Book of John. Gnostics didn't believe humans were guilty of being sinful in some cases. Also, often you find this idea that Christ did not actually die on the cross, that the Christ escaped, or the Christ being, whatever that is, somehow separated from Jesus on the cross because the divine God could not die. Something immortal could not die, in other words. So, in this sense, then, if there isn't this original sin idea, it's not about salvation from sin. It's rather a salvation from spiritual ignorance and darkness, unconscious unawareness of the true reality, the divine reality. And in this sense, then the soteriology, in other words, what is the salvation from for the Gnostics, for these Gnostics that we're talking about? Salvation is from ignorance through realization of one's own divinity, that the human beings are also God. So Jesus Christ, who as in the diagram I showed, is another one of these divine cosmic beings among all the aeons and others. This being then secretly sneaks down to earth in order to transmit the gnosis about one's own personal divinity. And another famous Gnostic text, the Gospel of Thomas, has some sayings in it. It's not really a story, but there are many sayings that are all just about this, about how to become conscious of your own personal divinity. And so this is what is meant by this idea that that's the Christ's role. He's like this teacher of waking up all of these slumbering, unconscious humans from the ignorance of their own divinity, their own divine spark. And so the fall of Sophia creates the Demiurge and the Archons, as we talked about. And what's interesting about these Archons is it's a Greek word that means ruler. And you find talk of the Archons in Plato. It's just that, again, you're finding this Platonism mixed with Christian stuff reinterpreted in new ways here again. And all these Archons are here trying to prevent human beings from reuniting with the transcendent God through the awareness of their own divinity. And it's interesting for me to, I mentioned the Matrix earlier. One of the things that I've taught about before is science fiction and religion, and we have a whole section on Gnosticism because Gnosticism is found in many science fiction tropes. And because we're kind of staying in antiquity here, I didn't go into this, but just to mention briefly, like the Matrix is the perfect, Gnostic fairy tale in a certain sense, a Gnostic mythical story, because you have the Archons here preventing these people from waking up out of the Matrix. So it's something like that is the idea of these Archons.
keeping human beings, preventing them from accessing ultimate absolute reality. Perhaps, and again, this is like with the Androgyne Adam idea, the notion of principalities and rulers in Christianity is somehow also this, related to this similar idea. It's just articulated in different ways. One is perhaps more esoteric than the other, but you know, not technically. If you start digging into dominions and powers and so forth, it's really deep stuff. But we have it interpreted differently. And in this case, we could say that these Gnostics have their own esoteric, I mean, for them, for sure, because it's not the official Orthodox doctrine. They have their own esoteric understanding of what are these principalities and dominions. For them, they are these archons working for the evil demiurge in an effort to keep human beings in the dark. Just to show you an illustration here, if anyone who has read any about Gnosticism or knows, even has delved into it to some extent, has probably come across this idea of Abraxas. And this is an illustration of Abraxas, which is another Greek word related to the great archon or the 365 rulers or something like that. So here you can, and there's a lot more to it than that. I'm just showing you an example here of potentially how some of these Gnostic groups thought about and then illustrated. These are some old pendants and coins or something showing the idea of the archon with the, and there's some similarities, sort of half, partly animal, part bird, sometimes part snake or part human, often with some kind of ritual items or weapons or something. To bring this all the way back to the beginning then, and the idea of Platonism being mystery tradition, the Gnostics also had mystery rites. They also had a type of initiation. They had rituals. They had things that you had to do. You know, for a long time, I think Platonism was also, Platonic philosophy was considered more in terms of like an intellectual exercise or intellectual development. It wasn't really thought of as a religion, you know, but it's in a sense, it's a religion is what it is. And it involves rituals and there's things you had to do. And the same is to a certain extent true of Gnosticism. The Gnosticism was perhaps thought about more in terms of a religion, in terms of beliefs, certain kinds of beliefs, and wasn't focused so much on practice. And especially rituals, like what did these people actually do? And it turns out they did have rituals and they did have rites of initiation. And especially recently, you can read more about this. And as far as I can tell, the kind of rituals they had were related to, obviously, these Platonic mystery rites, these Greco-Roman rites, but they also were influenced by this Hermetic literature that I just briefly mentioned, but we didn't go into. This coming from Egypt. So you have this Egyptian influence and this Greco-Roman influence. But of course, the Roman Empire is absorbing Egyptian religion and Egyptian mystery cults all through this period. So this syncretist process, this syncretic context is also part of Gnosticism. And it's something, you know, like this, that we talked before about death, about meditation, about getting closer to death, that somehow bringing yourself closer to your body or something, thinking it's dead, plays a role in the rite of initiation, this encounter with death before you actually die. And it's something similar here with these Gnostic initiations, because one of the things they were doing there is referred to, the academics refer to it as incubation. You might have heard of it in another way, sometimes called a temple sleep. This is something like where a person goes to a temple, goes through a ritual in a sense of initiation, like a secret ritual. And in part of this, they go to in there to sleep. They go to the temple to sleep, and something is supposed to happen to them. But it's not just sleeping. It's, you know, incubation. You're like putting yourself in, it's like in a womb. You're putting yourself in the temple in a womb-like state. And this can be done through meditation. You're also ingesting substances can be part of this, because, you know, if you take a
slightly poisonous substance to hallucinate or something, this also is poison. So your body, you think maybe it's dying. All these things like bring up this artificial death. And the sleep, of course, is the closest one can get to death. And if we're to believe all these esoteric thinkers who are exploring throughout this course, they almost all of them have some idea that like when you're asleep, some part of you leaves your body, whether it's the spirit, the pneuma part, or the psychic, the soul part, that the body stays in this catatonic state, and some subtle part of you, some other part of you leaves the body and has different kinds of experiences, gets different kind of knowledge. And this, as far as I can tell, I think this is something like what was going on here. We don't really know what they were doing, but as far as we could, partly because they were secret and partly because we had only a limited amount of text, but it seems to me that something like they were doing is for sure related to incubation, but it's something like the person goes there through this to sleep, to go into this state of this incubation state, and as they're doing that, they're led on basically a kind of guided visualization by other members of the group, maybe a hierophant, maybe a leader of the group, or a priest, or just like the other members or something. And that the Gnostics were doing this. So if you imagine someone being in this catatonic state and then hearing this guided meditation, visualization, this was part of the process to undergo the initiation for the Gnostics. And it was very cosmic, actually. And this is, again, brings in this interesting science fiction connection. Because when you read about it, they were like trying to go out into the cosmos. So they wanted to reach past heaven, sometimes through the underworld, to get to what is on the other side of all of that. And it's basically like you enter the cosmos and you enter the stars, and there's different ideas about different stars, different portals to go through related to different stars, and this sort of thing. And it's through this meditation process, this incubation process, that they cultivate the vehicle in which to do this, which sometimes referred to as the light body. And so you cultivate this light body, which is like a more conscious vehicle to use when you're in this incubation state to travel around the stars. Basically, it's like the Jetsons or something. It's your own private UFO that you're making, a thought form UFO related to a subtle body. And you shed these intellectual layers of self and worldview. You go into this incubation state, and you're led on this visualization. And this is how you receive the visionary experiences the way they talk about it, these basically. It is true there's individual experiences, but they kind of confirm the beliefs of the group. Like you encounter the figures in the mythology, maybe you encounter Sophia, things like this. So you encounter the elements of the system, of the group, but in this visionary experiential mode, while you're in this experiential mode, while you're in this incubation state. To a certain extent, we can also place the Manichaeans in the list of Gnostics, and the Manichaeans are also placed there. Then I mentioned the Mandaeans as well, but the Manichaeans I'm focusing on a lot in this course. They're also just interesting for me personally, especially in relation to modern esoteric expressions of Christianity, which I've found in Steiner, in the White Brotherhood in Bulgaria, in some of the Neo-Cathar movement. So I'm really interested in tracking down this Manichaean expression in esoteric Christianity, or this Neo-Manichaean part of it, because I don't think it's very well known, to be honest. And so when we look at the Manichaeans, of course, are coming from Persia. So I'm going to end on a kind of going left field here for a second, might seem, but I think it's important for us to realize that these Gnostic groups are not only groups that we might talk about as schools of Gnostic thought, are not only happening in the Greco-Roman world or something, but they're also happening in different parts of the world. And you find these Neoplatonic ideas especially go into Islam and Sufism and different strains of that religion in really interesting ways that actually I think has a connection to esoteric Christianity as we find it in the West. Even though you might not think that, but this whole process, in a certain sense, is this dialogue between East and West, or this back and forth between Eastern and Western ideas. Reincarnation, metempsychosis is another example. And so, within this Islamic context as well, there are groups that can be considered Gnostic, especially in early expressions of Shiism. And that's what I want to just end on here with this slide here I'm showing you, is the word golat means extremist, but not extremist like in the sense of violence or something, but extremist in the sense of going too far with the Shia. Shia means follower of Ali. And some elements in the early Shia movement were said to have gone too far with their interpretations of Ali, their reverence for Ali, things like this. And these are referred to, I'm not sure if by themselves or only by their detractors again, but as gulat, meaning they're too extreme with their devotion to Ali, something like that. But what's interesting about this is they believed that Ali and his family, the Ahl Bayt, this whole group, that they were divine beings incarnated in the flesh. And because they were divine beings incarnated in the flesh, it was also possible for the followers of the Ahl Bayt, the family of the Prophet and Ali, also to attain divine state in their life. So they're also to be divine, as a human also to be divine, in other words. This is this Gnostic, one of these Gnostic ideas that I want you to think about. And there's more than that. The group also possessed complex cosmology filled with angels and demons. Not exactly like the Valentinian stuff I was showing you, but their own version of their own esoteric expression of something similar, of a cosmology, of a creation story, and the way spiritual realities work now. They also had elements of Tanasuk, or reincarnation, this metempsychosis. This also was a part of it, and some of it is strikingly similar to these other Gnostic cosmologies. So one scholar of Gnosticism, Dylan Burns, he has said that the term Islamic Gnosticism is something of a misnomer, but it is nonetheless clear that especially the Gulat and other Shia groups, such as the Alevis, they were products of the same Syrian Mesopotamian religious milieu of the first century CE, in which the Gnostics, Manichaeans, and Mandeans freely exchanged and developed ideas among their Jewish, Christian, and Muslim contemporaries. It's the end of a quote there, but he's pointing out that it's not just limited to this Greco-Roman, within the Roman Empire or something, that there's actually this whole religious landscape. This is very syncretic, and there's some of these ideas are circulating through all of these groups. And I want to bring this in because later, especially in the Byzantine period, with the so-called Great Heresy, and when Byzantium falls, and the Eastern Roman Empire finally falls, and so forth, I think some of these ideas circulate back in, and that's how we get something like esoteric Christianity now. And of course, the story of Plethon and Ficino is the least legendary moment in history where this happens, which we talk about in the Ficino episode. And the Gulat, you can sort of happening out there, in the East, quote unquote, in the East, and they deified Ali. And even though, according to the sources, some sources, Ali didn't like this and even killed some of them for trying to say he was God or something. But they have a trinity of Ali, Muhammad, and Salman al-Farsi, who is one of the early Persian followers of the Prophet. They also had a form of a sacrament that they practiced. They believed, and they still do apparently, in the form of the Alevis, who are still in Syria. They believe in this idea of metempsychosis, or transmigration of souls. And Ali supposedly had several preparatory incarnations. And it's very similar, especially with Steiner, how the story of Jesus and the Christ had these also preparatory incarnations in order to become the Christ. Of course, all of this, what I'm talking about here, is very controversial. And the Gulat have been attacked by both Shiites and Sunni throughout history. But it's important because they contain Christian elements of the Armenian variety and have even been described as nominal Christians by some scholars. So the inclusion of elements of metempsychosis in a Christian context can be, but is not always, a characteristic of esoteric Christianity. So I wanted to show that, there are certain things that we can say esoteric Christianity has and quote unquote orthodox or non-esoteric Christianity has, this metempsychosis, this idea of reincarnation, is a pretty key one, actually. And just as a side note here, as I'm ending, some of these groups also even have said that there are two Christs and that there are two Jesuses, and Ali is one of them. So we'll end it there. Thank you.